Makes sense.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the timingresearch.com crowd forecast news, episode number 273 for August 10th, 2020. We are recording this at 1 p.m. Eastern time. My name is David Kosmeter. I'm the creator of timingresearch.com. And today we are going to be talking about the S&P 500 and other active markets. So today I've arranged for Neil Batho to join us, and you can see his screen right now. And also the option professor is here to moderate. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to him.
Okay, great. And for people that are not familiar with us or the show, newcomers, Neil, if you'd be kind enough to give a quick background on yourself and the company and you know, a little bit of a get familiar update.
Sure, Jan. Thanks for having me on the show again, David. Let's see. I was a broker in 98-99, and I got a lot of free lunches from mutual funds that want us to sell their funds. And it was fantastic training. We sat in an office for 2 months, and then you get your Series 7 exam, which only about, I think, 70% of the people pass it. And if you don't pass it, you don't go to work the next day. And so I quickly learned in the industry that it's really just a sales industry. So any type of good sales experience, you will get hired at a brokerage firm. And the best thing that brokers do for people, I find, is to make sure you don't sell at the very, very bottom. So a lot of people that trade by themselves, they'll get trapped into just throwing in the towel at they'll hold, and then they'll just throw in the towel at the bottom, and that's the worst thing you could do. So, so if you're the type of person that does that, maybe a broker is good for you, but it's really just asset gathering is what they taught us. So you get paid based on how many assets you gather under your umbrella. And so I'm more interested in doing the actual analysis of the stock picks. And so I was really glad I had that experience. And then I went on to other things and have been writing my newsletter using some of the techniques that I actually learned when I was a broker, mainly, which was point and figure charting, which is one of my most main methodologies. And I'm one of the few newsletters, or maybe the only newsletter, that uses point and figure charting.
Great. And, you know, asset gathering is a whole separate business. You're obviously doing more granular research, and your people that work with you are looking for hopefully better results than they would get just by buying the S&P. And that's the idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. All the fund managers out there, by the way, their bonuses depend on if they beat the S&P. And it also depends on something called the Sharpe ratio, which is the volatility in the account as well. But, you know, back when I was a broker and they wanted us to gather assets, you know, you get a percent fee on those assets. And our whole pitch was that we weren't managing your money, but we were managing the managers. So we would find the best private money managers. You need at least $100,000 to be in these instead of mutual funds. And they are far better managers than mutual funds most of the time. And so we would track the managers and instead of managing the money, because the managers managed the money.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't believe in big diversification in your account. I believe in being in just the proper sectors, because the sectors are where you're going to get your gains. Either it's gold, it's going to be oil, like in the 2000s, and of course, gold again, but not oil. And, you know, either tech or biotech, things like that. You know, there's no reason to be diversified everywhere, because you're never really going to make a lot of money if you're diversified everywhere. You're just not going to lose a lot of money. So
yeah, it moderates the upside, and it also supposedly moderates the downside. That's the theory behind diversification. And like you say, you know, it can be Peter pays Paul and kind of moderate things. Anyway, let's go with our general question that we have in the beginning of every week. And that is, the S&P opened up at 3356. And what's your guess on where we're going to be by Friday?
Well, I'm going to say up, but I'm going to bite my fingernails a little bit while I'm doing it. Just because you have to go with the indicators before you go with your intuition, unless you're at an absolute extreme high. That will be pretty obvious with a huge gap up and complete chaos of a buying frenzy. You know, then every indicator will say buy, but that's when you don't. And so now we're not really there, and I'm just going to go with the indicators that are basically saying, you know, you can stay in this market, but I'm definitely expecting, you know, some volatility. So we have to hang through it, not put our stops too close, and think about position sizing.
Yeah, we're very close, 30, 40 points away from the 52-week high, all-time high on the S&P.
Yeah.
So, you know, one would imagine they're going to and make a run at that possibly, right?
That's where a lot of people are going to have their sell orders in. Funds are going to have their sell orders in there. So, yeah, you got to be careful around that level, definitely.
There's been some really great catch-up trades going on in the transports and the Russell 2000. Do you look at that at all, or that's not on your radar?
You know what I've been actually looking at, Jim, is because I've been looking the past maybe month and a half of growth versus value, because right. I thought that a lot of people have 401ks, and you kind of have a choice, don't you, where you say, hey, you want this growth stock, you want the value, you want the blend. And I know the growth has been outperforming value for so long, and I found an ETF that was a small cap value. It's up 15% in the last 6 weeks.
Exactly. This is something I've been committed to for the last month and a half, because the people that are on the sideline, my theory is would be more interested in a 14 or 15 PE ratio with a 2.5% to 3.5% yield on a big name company than it would be on putting their money into Zoom at 290, hoping it goes to 390.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, you know, and we'll see how it goes. Right now, it does seem to be working out pretty good, though, as you were mentioning. The results on the small cap value, you know, has been nothing shameful. And I think you still get 2.5% on most of those things, too, right?
Yeah, I don't have the yield in front of me, but it's probably somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about value is sometimes value can blast off. It's really oversold.
Yeah, and the other thing is these people are making no money in fixed income, so they're going to have to do something to make a yield. And, you know, that's going to be somewhat the attractiveness, the relative, because, you know, these PE ratios on tech and mega growth is, you know, enormous right now. Not all of them, but not all of them, but some.
I like small cap growth. I think it's too risky.
Yeah. Yeah.
People want the real names for growth. Small cap growth, you're basically saying 30% chance of bankruptcy, you know, 30% chance, maybe the same as S&P, and 30% chance beat the S&P. So small cap growth is risky.
Do you use moving averages at all in your analysis?
I do, and that's a secret weapon of mine I'm going to use later in the show.
We're kind of extended on some of those tech stocks and mega growth from their moving averages quite a bit, huh?
Well, do you want me to show you my moving average?
Yeah, why don't we jump in there?
Okay, let me just figure out here. I'm going to go to watch list. Okay, I had it ready here.
Mm-hmm.
So what you can see here, do you see the MMTW at the top there?
Absolutely.
Okay, so this was something I learned from Point and Figure, where you have what are the percent of stocks above their 50-day moving average, 200-day moving average, 20-day moving average. And so you can also do it in normal candlesticks. And so the one you see on the top there is, so what percent of stocks in the S&P 500 are above their 20-day moving average. So you can see just today, it's already up 3%. The one below is, I don't know why they use these specific ticker symbols, because they don't make a lot of sense. The second one is how many stocks are above the 50-day moving average. And the last one is 200-day moving average. And so if I go here, the 20-day moving average, and we're going to go way back here between March and April, you can see at the bottom there, it's almost at zero.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where some people threw in the towel and sold. And then you can see just before April, it starts ticking up around 10% and then blasts off. So if you have a massive sell-off again and you're looking for a time to buy, look at the shorter time frame on the 20-day moving average.
Mm-hmm.
And the best overall one is probably the 50-day moving average, because you can see the same thing happened just above zero. And then it's more of a smoother curve. But the reason I was staying long, even though I was a little bit, you know, biting my nails the last couple of days, is if you look over here to the right, percent of stocks above the 50-day moving average keeps moving up.
Right.
Now, the thing about this is that the higher it gets, the weaker stocks are contributing, obviously. So the strongest stocks are going to move above their 50-day moving average first. And so as this starts ticking up, it's weaker and weaker and weaker stocks that are contributing to the market. So that's why you have to get nervous when this indicator gets to be a little bit too high, like it was back in June, probably up at about 90.
Right.
And then I can go back here. This is the 200-day moving average, and it takes a really long time. If something drops below the 200 on a big crash like we had, it's going to take months before a lot of these stocks, you know, start coming back. But as you can see, stocks continue to move more and more and more above their 200-day moving average. But if you look right before the crash, we're at about 67% of stocks above the 200-day moving average. And I'll just, yeah, so, you know, once this gets up to, let's say, around the 67 area again,
mm-hmm.
then I'm going to really, really start looking to
trim at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. There are some who believe that in Q3 here, we are going to hit some kind of a high point, and maybe even here in the month of August, and then we may see a precipitous decline in September, October, going into the election. Do you have any evidence that that's possible, either on your point and figure or anything else?
Well, I can tell you what I know from the Stock Traders Almanac.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That's a fantastic book full of everyone. If you trade, you have to have this book. I mean, even especially if you're a type of statistics guy, and it will definitely give you a hand up in your trading. And it has so many things, and they really specialize in the presidential cycle. And so basically, if stocks rally 3 months before the election, the incumbent has won over 80% of the time since the 50s. Hmm. And so, you know, we're in an election year, and you cannot deny the election year. So you just have to go with, if the market continues to rally, it's probably going to keep rallying. I would say in a non-election year, August is usually quite weak, and there's a sell-off after Labor for a couple weeks.
Now, on the QQQ and your point and figure work, is there any evidence of a turn up here in the 275 area, or there's just not enough pullback here to indicate that?
I can't bring up point and figure on here today. Sorry, Jeff.
Oh, okay.
I only have the cloud today.
I got you. And the cloud on QQQ is obviously very positive, probably still, right?
Well, I've got the NASDAQ 100 here.
Yeah, same idea.
Sorry about this histogram. I pressed a button recently, and it's floating around, and I can't seem to get rid of it in time for the show. Mm-hmm. And so what I use here is these clouds are support and resistance areas. They're basically moving averages and volatility projected forward. Mm-hmm. So basically, above the cloud is hold, below the cloud is sell. Mm-hmm. So you can see clearly here back in March, if you got out below the cloud, you missed a big sell-off. Mm-hmm. Then it's sort of your prerogative where to buy. But if you were to just go based on the cloud, you missed a big sell-off and you basically got in where you left off and your account didn't get hurt very badly. But we actually use point and figure techniques to get out before the sell-off,
right?
Which was when, like I showed you with the percent of stocks above the moving averages, there's a point and figure indicator called bullish percent, which shows what percent of stocks are on buy signals, like a short-term buy signal. And that ticked down from a high level 2 weeks before the crash. And it's called the bullish percent indicator. And every crash, basically in history, it will always tick down because you can't have a crash without technicals deteriorating, obviously, right?
Right.
So if it starts ticking down, I mean, you're not just going to have a fantastic market and then all of a sudden Dow is down 10,000 in a day. Right?
Unless they do something like we had in March where everybody's just panicking.
Yeah, I mean, like a flash crash to the extreme, but there's always going to be some smart people getting out before a crash, and that will come up in the bullish percent. And I've been waiting for this for literally a year or two. I just said, I know there has to be something. I was even on the show in January and I said, there's going to be a crash. I don't know when it's going to be, yeah, but buy gold and silver and hang out on the beach for 6 months.
Right.
And check the archives. So
now this cloud, you can extrapolate it to later in the month, right? There you go.
So yeah,
as we get to September, if we were to break under 10,000, then the market would be under the cloud.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can change the time frame as well. So I can go here. Let's say I'll go to a 4-hour cloud,
which is more short term.
Yeah. So pretty volatile because the NASDAQ is volatile, you know. Yeah. But if you're getting in a trade like an ETF, you can do the 4-hour or the 1-hour and you can just hold it. And we were doing that. And I'll give away my pick of the day, which is Nail. This is a triple leveraged ETF in the housing industry.
Oh.
And it's not just housing stocks, it's also stocks like Home Depot and Lumber Liquidators.
Lumber Liquidators is starting to pick up too. Do you know the price of lumber has doubled?
I do.
And I'm just wondering, and it's at its all-time high. And I'm just wondering if, A, would that be very good for Lumber Liquidators, which is trying to make a move here a bit? Or would it be a negative for the industry because their raw materials have gone up so high?
That's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, if gasoline was at zero, I guess it means no one's buying, but you'd think it would be good for cars. Or no one's driving, but it would be good for cars, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Obviously there's a significant demand for lumber. You don't get up to the all-time highs with no demand. What's Lumber Liquidator? LL, right? Yeah. I saw it like it's starting to go at 21, 22 bucks. Yeah, you see it's starting to build something there. And if you went back 10 years, this stock used to be, what, 70 or 80 or something?
Yeah, I actually did love it. You know, I missed this by a couple of days, unfortunately, you know, for my readers. And then I kind of been watching it ever since. But yeah, back, it just blasted off like crazy. 110, 2018.
And when was that? Back in the 2013, 14, huh?
Yeah, 2014, yeah. So this is a monthly chart here.
Although it's a little inexplicable that it hasn't even done better than it has with Lennar and Pulte and ITB doing so well, right?
Yeah, I guess.
But it's had a good run. I guess it would have gone 8
to
20.
Those wood floors, you know.
Yeah, I did notice that, though. It's an interesting one that, you know, I'm not an expert on the company, but I assume they sell lumber, huh?
Well, you know, Jim, I just had this thought. If there's anyone here in the Midwest or anywhere where they got a lot of barns, uh-huh. got some kids that need a job, get them to get some old wood from the barns, sandblast them, make them look all nice, and sell them. People love that stuff. Or get some old barn doors and redo their floors. People would love old wood from a barn that's 100 years old that's reconditioned.
They like that 1776 feeling on their floor, right?
Well, I personally love that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
anyone wants to
now my buddy did his my buddy did his place in New York City with that stuff, and I could tell it was kind of popular now. Nail really has been popping here today for you, huh?
Yeah, we've been holding it for about a week.
Yeah,
and it's a triple leverage, and you got to hold through that volatility, which is really tough sometimes.
Yeah, a million shares too, Neil. You got good volume there, huh?
I actually didn't check the volume. Didn't have time.
Yeah,
but looking here, for example, this is the 1 hour cloud,
mm-hmm.
and so you can just hold, for example, set it to a good time frame like that,
mm-hmm.
and even a triple leveraged ETF, and it was still holding this 1 hour cloud since the 30s. So we didn't get up here until about I think around 38. Because I actually didn't know about it. I didn't know about this really great ETF.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to...
going up, right?
And you got a great sector there because the whole thing is about these millennials coming out and starting to buy a lot of homes. And, you know, with the rates so low, everybody wants to buy something. And so there's a real fever going on in that industry right now.
Yeah, do you know the 30-year rate now, Jim? Because I know it's below 3.
Like 2, I thought it was 289 or 298 or something like that.
I don't know. Last I checked was 292 was the lowest, but it keeps ticking down.
Yeah.
I was also something I predicted in January because I said it's really, you got to get these people into houses or they're just going to start freaking out.
Now, what about in the metal sector? You know, some of those metal stocks really have stalled a little bit. Is it just a stall or is there more to it?
Yeah, stall in gold is definitely because the U.S. dollar fall has stalled.
Right.
You know, so here's the dollar index. 50% of this is the euro. And you can see it sort of hit that double bottom right around 92.50.
Uh-huh.
And that was a good sign of a bottom.
Right.
And I'm not really a bottom fisher, hardly ever. But this is certainly a time where, I mean, here's the dollar index on the daily. And then it was a bit sketchy because, I mean, there is the virus problem in the U.S. and the U.S. has the most powerful central bank in the world, you know, probably more powerful than the ECB. And, you know, how much more stimulus are they really going to have? So, you know, back here in July, it was almost never ending, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so now there appears to be some more gridlock in things. And so that's what I think put in a floor in the dollar, which put in a ceiling in gold, you know, because gold only moves when the deficit ramps up like crazy in the U.S. I mean, it's not going to do anything. If the U.S. had a balanced budget, gold would never do anything up, right? So it's only deficits that cause gold to go up.
You know, I've been looking at a stock that you might have some good technical information on, Freeport-McMoRan, FCX. Obviously, in years past, it's been substantially higher than it is now. And this $14 area seems to be very interesting as far as support is concerned. If it can maintain here, maybe it could get going. Do you have any technicals that gives you any idea? You know,
I remember when Freeport bought Phelps Dodge, part of the Dow. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a big company and a lot of, you know, large investors are in there.
Yeah.
But it was a dog for a long time too.
Yeah. And it was also, I mean, the place to be. Look at the left-hand part of the chart.
Yeah.
You know, this was
when you come out of the last recession, And then in 08, you come out of the last recession. Sometimes these markets, you know, they come out of the recession and that's when they get some legs, right?
Well, I mean, if I look to the left of the chart, I mean, 2002, 2003, we all know what was happening. happening back then, you know, overseas, et cetera. So if I look to the left, we were in an environment where interest rates were going down for quite a while. Uh-huh. And so sort of a trend, a downward trend. And so that's an upward trend in housing and upward trend in commodity prices. But now the interest rates are already at zero. So where are we going to go? You know, I don't think they're ever going to go negative. But I mean, I definitely think if I look at this chart, 30 would be a great target.
And from 14 to 30 is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, or perhaps even 40, because obviously it's one of the biggest copper companies in the world, you know, and you need copper for building.
That's right? What I was thinking. But like I say, it's, you know, it's not roaring as much as I would think. But, you know, you can't, in the 52-week high and low, 482 to 1475 is a pretty decent range if you've been bullish, you know?
Yeah, and it did break out over the last two highs at the beginning of the year in April of last year. So it recently just broke what you'd call a spread triple top.
Yeah, because yeah, you're trying to find things that haven't happened already. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's you can buy stuff that's already, you know, way at its all-time high, and then you could try to see some other things that might be, you know, the next games in town.
Do you know what the yield is on FCX, Jim?
There's no yield because these guys were distressed for a while, so they had to kill the dividend.
Yeah, no, I like it. I mean, doesn't matter that it tripled off the bottom. Lots of stocks. I mean, what would have happened if you bought Apple after it tripled off the bottom of the IPO, right?
And also okay. that 485 was a distressed, the world, the circumstances have changed, obviously, since that price.
Yeah, and you know, if someone wants to get into this, a great way to do it without getting stressed out is just start scaling in with a little bit. You know, maybe put 1,000 in it, and you feel better, it goes up, put another 1,000 in. You don't let it get away from you, but you know, don't just drop in 30,000 and it pulls back to, you know, 11 and you think, oh man.
Yeah, right.
Just start scaling in and then you feel better about the trade. And then
Volume today, almost 8 million shares already. So there's a couple of people in America who's doing something with it.
It's a winner. FCX is going to be around a long time. You have to have copper for building. Interest rates are an all-time low. I mean, FCX is definitely a buy. If I was a fund manager and they said you have to hold 10 picks for at least a year, it would definitely be one of those picks. There's no question.
How about another one that's out of favor? And the banking, the banks are going, but this one's lagging still. Wells Fargo, WFC?
I never touch it because of those MAMs that they pulled.
Yeah, I mean,
fake account. Obviously, yeah. I don't even remember.
But they seem like they still have a ton of customers and a ton of branches and a ton of money in their house. You know what I mean?
Well, they got a cool symbol with the wagon and stuff and people think it's cool.
And they got a new boss in there who I'm sure has got a machete going through the place.
Okay. I didn't even know about, I knew. So the CEO is out.
Oh yeah. They got a new guy and he's cutting this and he's cutting that and he's cutting this. And the next thing you know, your revenues come back. You've cut out all your expenses and bingo, you know, you have something going. You know, Buffett is still holding a very large position in it. Not adding. He's adding to Bank of America. But, you know, time heals all wounds. And at some point, whatever they did maybe, you know, healed. And anyway, right now, it's still fighting. You know, it's still weak. Still weak.
Yeah, I would just watch it for a while and then see it drops to 10.
Yeah, or if it starts taking out 26, 27, then you want to jump on that train.
Yeah, or if there's some people who know some complicated option strategies.
Yeah. Limited risk. Go out, do a leap or something like that. Even do a leap or something like that and see if the tide will turn in the next year or two.
Yeah, it's just not my thing. What are they even paying a dividend, Jim?
Oh, yeah, but they cut it down to 1.63%. The industry's paying between 2.5 and 3.
Well, maybe the whole thing will crash and it'll get bought out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anything can happen. But I would say this is if they're not going out of business and they can correct their problems, you know, it is trading, what, 50 cents or less on the dollar from where it was. Do you have any other sectors that you're kind of watching? You know, you went over the home builders, which was obviously a very good sector to be in. Is there any other sector that you think might be coming on, like energy or, you know, financials in general or something? Or?
Well, it's funny you mention that because I'm actually wanted to talk about financials without Wells Fargo.
Right.
If you get a chance while I'm talking, Jim, if you could look up the price to book of Wells Fargo versus Bank of America. America, that would be a good
let's see if I can get that
interesting number.
Well, I don't know how current this is. Let's see if they can. Still looks like it might be trading under book. Yeah, so I think, I can't guarantee this, but according to what I'm reading, it seems like it's still trading under book value, which most of the banks, I think, are, except maybe JP Morgan.
Yeah.
I thought Citi was one of the better ones for price to book.
Yeah, a lot of these financials, they look the same. They, I mean, they had that big run up, and then, you know, they're just worried about, are they really going to be able to do enough lending? But the housing industry is already ahead of the banks, you know. So I think that the housing industry can pull up the financial sector. You know, I don't know about
maybe they have overcompensated with their provisions, is what you're saying? Their loss provisions are a little bit way more than they're going to need?
You know, I heard about that JP Morgan has put away. Do you know what it is, Jim?
It's a ton of money.
So much money. In case of losses on loans.
Yeah,
because I guess the government told them they don't want another Fannie and Freddie fiasco.
Right.
I haven't even followed Fannie and Freddie for years. I don't even know what's happening there. But, you know, I think that the housing industry is going to keep going and people are going to get loans. And, you know, there's going to have to be incentives to get people into houses, especially these millennials, because we got to get them out of their parents' basements. or maybe it's Generation Z. Is that the one?
Something like that. Where the big money is supposed to be made is between the 20-year-old to the 32-year-old, which is the millennials. And they're supposed to be inheriting a tremendous amount of money. And they are very large in size. In fact, there is a ETF that I follow called Millennials Thematic, MILN. And what it does is it follows the likes and dislikes of the group. And it's actually performed quite well. You can see there that, you know, people are kind of trying to go with where these people will be spending their money.
Okay. So Spotify and things like that?
I guess, you know, like I say, you'd have to look behind the curtain. I don't have that right in front of me, but it's an ETF. It's a thematic, and it's following the whims and the desires of the millennial generation. And
until, of course, Jim, the millennials are in power, where they will then regulate to their own benefit, correct?
Oh, probably. But they'll have a lot of money to do it, because supposedly I've heard numbers like $75 trillion they're going to be inheriting in the next 10 years.
Or their parents will just blow it all on vacations.
Yeah, that could happen too.
Or in Vegas. I don't know. So
yeah, some of the holdings of these guys, just to give you an idea, is PayPal, Square, Apple, eBay, Spotify, like you mentioned, Lowe's, Amazon, Facebook, you know. So that's the kind of stuff that's been running, and that's the kind of stuff that these guys are into. Lululemon, Home Depot, Activision, Netflix, Disney, Intuit. So, you know, those would be the kind of companies that would be interesting to the generation we just mentioned. And that's obviously, those are pretty big winners in the last 6 months.
Yeah, but the only thing is these people don't have any money. So we have
to like I say, as people perish, their money goes to the next group, you know?
Mm.
I think that's the, it's a thematic thing. It certainly doesn't have to work, but so far it has been going fairly well. And you can see from the companies that are in it, you know, at least the 15 holdings that I mentioned, you know, that would, you know, because these guys definitely like to buy stuff online. They definitely like to use their iPhones. They definitely like to get deals on eBay. You know, they definitely like to be in social media. So this is the stocks that they're in there. And it's just, you know, just something I found kind of interesting. And it may have some perpetuity to it, you know?
You know, I tried to do a business call a few months ago, and the guy wouldn't even call me on my home number.
There
he
you
wanted
go.
To schedule a Zoom call.
There you go.
I'm like, dude, just call me at 2 o'clock. Here's my number. He wouldn't do it.
Since I would have no idea what these guys are doing, I would just go with this thing and let them figure it out. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. This reminds me of back when I was a broker, Harry Dent was the gospel of trading back then. And he had written a book called The Roaring 2000s. But in the 90s, he wrote a book called The Boom Ahead. And that was where at the early 1990s, he predicted Dow 10,000. And then lo and behold, the Dow hit 10,000 at I think the end of 1998. And everyone thought, oh my God, this guy is talking about generational spending waves, peak spending, and you know, all these types of things. And then, so I read the book Roaring 2000s. There was a Roaring 2000s ETF, like a trust you could buy. And then he predicted Dow 40,000, and no one followed him anymore because the market crashed. So
he also was the guy saying gold was going to go to like 700 or 500 or something, and it went the other way, huh?
Yeah, you know, I mean, but there's definitely something to it with these generational spending waves,
right?
You know, but on the other hand, you know, I also follow the money supply itself. I'm gonna bring up the money supply because that's it's a really important one.
Yeah.
Is well, you've been talking about how much money are people gonna spend in these types of things, but on the other hand, there's only a certain amount of money that exists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can look at the M2 money supply, and there used to be an M3 money supply, and they don't do it anymore, probably because it's so huge, people would freak out. But that's not what they say anyway. So this is how much money exists in the U.S. And you can see going back to 1999, only about $6 trillion. Now we're up to 18-something trillion. And if you zoom in, you can actually see the bailout from the financial crisis right here, right at that early end of 2008. Big jump up there was the bailout and stimulus. And then as you can see, I'm just going to bring it over here to the right. Like right about here, you can see as the money supply starts to grow and increase right about there, that's when you get into the market because money is starting to flow and business is happening, loans are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can see the new bailout here, which makes the financial crisis look like nothing.
No, this is off the charts. It almost looks like Mnuchin is doing a leverage buyout of the economy and then the Fed is printing money to pay for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then basically everyone's got a sugar high now because obviously the stock market is going to go up when you put interest rates at zero in the bank and then you provide this much liquidity and then you start buying everything to support it from junk bonds to corporate bonds, which really in the Act of 1913 doesn't seem like it's permissible. You know, the Fed Act of 1913. So they're pretty far out of bounds unless there's some, tiny line that says if you set up 11 different facilities, you can print money and put them in those facilities. But how far away are we from just printing money and just giving it to people like the Weimar Republic? And how far are we from a situation where they start buying stocks?
Yeah, I need to do a little bit more studying of Weimar Republic.
Uh-huh.
What I do know is that if you held stocks during it, you didn't lose any money. I'm going to have to double check because I found that many years ago, but inflation also goes into stocks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So if I go back to that money supply, how it tripled from 1999, well, guess what? In 1999, Dow was 10,000. It hit almost 30,000.
Right.
So a trip of the money supply and you have a tripling of the stock market, you know? You also have a tripling of how much your lunch cost because back then you could get a burger, fries, and a Coke for $9.95, right?
Right.
And I'm pretty sure now it's $29.95
yeah.
at a mid-range restaurant in the city, you know? So are people really getting wealthier or does the market just keep you safe from inflation?
Yeah, because the world is going to go on way beyond November and some of the tactics seem to be to give everyone a little bit of a jolt in the arm between now and November. And then, because again, if the unemployment stays as high as it is, whatever they've printed, this guy at Bridgewater Associates was mentioning this, imagine how much we've printed in the first 90 days of the crisis. What if the crisis goes on for 8 more quarters as far as employment and things like that? Do you realize how much money would have to continue to be printed? Because, you know, those 20 million people that are unemployed or whatever it is, 16 million, you know, they're probably not that interested in the stock market being at an all-time high because they're not participating in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's almost like you just got to go to work with a space suit on you.
Yeah.
I just don't see any other way around it unless we're talking about 100% inflation coming, you know?
And I think the participation rate on the employment is just a little bit above 50, which means you got a lot of people with time on their hands.
And hopefully they're listening to our show.
Hopefully they're not gathering down at the square.
Because we're telling them to buy their kids a Spotify subscription and then buy the stock at the same time.
Any other sectors, though, that are coming into your focus a little bit? I mean, you know,
I've been big on housing ever since the market crashed.
Yeah.
And I knew they were going to cut rates. And whenever they cut rates, housing goes up. And, you know, the government, hopefully they know, or maybe it's just a fluke, that they know that when your house goes up in price, people love taking out home equity loans to buy boats and things like that. And that keeps the economy moving, you know?
Yeah. So, and again, your philosophy is a little bit of rather than having 52 cars in your deck, why don't we try to have 3 to 5 cards that work?
Yeah, absolutely. Just hold Jack, Queen, King, Ace. Why would you hold 2, 3, 4, 5?
Right. No, hey, listen, there's validity to that concept.
You know,
as long as those cards you get are the ones. And like, obviously right now, it seems like the home builders is definitely looking, you know, obviously like a place to be.
Yeah, I like it. I like that ETF we talked about earlier. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that there's always people out there with some money buying something, you know? So people might think we're in a recession. No, I don't think the home building's going to go, and et cetera. But you know what? There's always someone out there. I don't know who these people are, but they're definitely out there and they're definitely buying and they don't have money.
Yeah.
You know? So I like home building quite a lot. I read something recently that a lot of people are working from home and they're going to say, honey, it's time we redo that deck.
Is there anything in the energy sector that you could put up there that would give us an idea of how that is? Because banks and energies have really lagged. And if they were to play catch up, there's an opportunity there.
Yeah, I'm just going to bring up price of oil.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the light crude oil futures. It's not exactly the same as West Texas, but certainly looking okay. Oil at $40 is actually pretty cheap if you think about inflation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in 2003-04, it was starting to get kind of expensive. $40 oil, $50 oil. I remember filling up my car thinking, oh my God, dollar oil. But now, if you think about inflation, this would be like $20 oil back then, or even $15 oil, which is not that big a deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know, this is something interesting I looked at many times over the last 10, 15 years, especially back in the gold, silver boom in the early 2000s. I mean, back then, all we were doing was trading oil and gold. And so that's almost all we did. It's exactly where it had to be. But I was wondering if there was a way to, if you compare commodities to commodities. And so if you look at the price of oil now, but you're paying for it in silver coins, it's one of the cheapest prices it's ever been, you know, because how much is it going to cost you to fill up your tank? I mean, a silver coin is about $30. It's going to be what, 2/3 of a coin, maybe, depending on the size of your tank. So a silver coin is going to get you a tank of gas. That's pretty good in my opinion.
It's telling you that 40 crude is not long. It doesn't have a shelf life. We're going to be in the 50s or 60s before you know it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, because people still aren't quite driving enough. But people are going to drive more and more, and people are going to slowly start coming out of the house.
Jet fuel pick up once they start traveling.
Yeah, I'm, you know, I don't know the percentage of jet fuel to the overall fuel.
But I think there's some aspect to that, isn't there?
I think it's around, I can't even make a speculation at this point, but I remember looking it up. I can't remember off the top of my head.
How about the XLE? Can we see what that looks like?
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a tangible asset, and it's, all the talk of electric cars. I heard Buffett say, I don't know, did he say 26 million cars are on the road or 260 million? And they're not going to go all electric in the next 5 years?
No, absolutely not. There's going to be some supply constraints on making these batteries and, you know, things like that. And there's going to be people that aren't going to buy an electric car until you drag them to buy it, you know?
Or until you go to the corner and there's an option to get electricity or oil or whatever.
Yeah.
Because not everybody wants to load up their electric car in their garage every night.
Well, I would love that.
But some wouldn't.
You know, I like the idea of the electric car, you know, go skiing, and it's a little bit cold. And then you say, okay, maybe this is our last run here. You finish your coffee and you just get on your phone, you warm the car up a bit. Right?
Yeah.
Can't do that with a gas car.
Someone was telling me that they don't talk much about the Tesla's repair bills if things have to be fixed. Someone was saying that the repairs can be rather significant.
Well, you just sweep that under the rug.
That's negative talk. Only talk the positive. But, you know, when you're selling cars, you don't talk about that kind of stuff, right?
Wasn't there a song, Accentuate the Positive? I remember
yeah.
I forget how it goes.
All right, now here's one for you that might be interesting. You know, we were talking about the metals, and obviously we all know gold and silver has gone nuts. But there's one that hasn't really gone nuts yet that may have some runway. And I was looking at the technicals on a long-term basis, and it's really just coming out of the garage, and that's platinum.
Okay.
Let's take a look there, because it's 30 times rarer than gold. And in history, it used to trade at a premium, and now it's trading at a way out discount.
Yeah.
And everybody says we don't use it as much. But, you know, that's what they said about silver when they said, hey, with the cameras going the way of the buffalo, silver will never be used for anything like it used to be. And now we're at $30 silver almost. So obviously that mentality is not always accurate.
Well, remember, Jim, Congress has the authority to coin money, not print money. And they're supposed to be coining that silver, but it's not happening. Platinum, you caught me, Jim, because we actually hold a this ETF. We hold a PPLT Platinum. It's sort of like the value sector in heavy metals. And it's pretty volatile because, you know, it is a precious metal, but it is also used in catalytic converters. And palladium is also used in catalytic converters. It depends if it's diesel or gas. And I've been looking it up recently. I can't remember the exact details, but palladium, one of the reasons it's gone just ballistic is because of the catalytic converters. But I like platinum here. Let's go to a monthly chart.
Yeah, this thing 10 years ago was going for $1,800.
Yeah, so let me look here. $2,200 a peak. And here we go. So, you know, I think it's definitely a value play. I would say in the near term, I think it can definitely outperform gold, because the only way gold's going up is if the deficit keeps getting bigger, you know, or Elon Musk figures out a way to use gold in ludicrous speed. So,
but that cloud would suggest that it needs to get to 1200 or better to see the open road.
No, and something this volatile and long term, I'm not even interested in cloud here at all. We'll just look at the double top here, which it's almost breaking from the beginning of the year.
Right.
And then what I would look to is back in 2014, around 1400, that would definitely be a target, because there's the expression in trading, ceilings or floors become ceilings, ceilings become floors. So that's the big floor that was broken. And so that's where your ceiling is going to be, you know, temporarily. But it's hard to go way, way back, you know, a decade looking for a type of resistance. So right now I would just look at maybe the weekly or the daily chart. And I would, if I wanted to get in here, I'd probably go for another breakout around 1048. So just a little bit above where we are now, just to have some more confidence.
Now, I did say this was the last one, but I lied. I got one more. TLT. Some people are thinking that there's a, you know, the rally back is going to fail from here, and there could be a decline in TLT coming. Do you, any evidence that that could be true?
Sorry, Jim, what was the question again?
The TLT. You know, some people are thinking that, you know, it peaked up at about 190 or something like that, or 180, whatever it was, or this one here is at 180. And then we've made the rally back up, and that it's having some problem at that former high point there, and that in the next month or so, it could roll over to the downside a bit. Do you see any evidence that that could be true?
Well, you definitely have to avoid bonds right now. And the reason is because there's a network of traders who don't like deficit and inflation. And when there's massive government stimulus, they will crash the bond market for revenge. And these people are called the bond vigilantes.
Oh, yeah, I heard them.
If you don't believe me, look it up, because they're just as real as the plunge protection team. Okay.
I mean, and we know there's a plunge protection team for sure. Right?
I mean, the plunge protection team is like the super friends, and the bond vigilantes is like Lex Luthor and his gang. And, and they work against each other. And yeah, so there's big talk. I just saw today something like on the Hill there, $2 trillion apart on what the stimulus should be, around $1 trillion or $3
trillion. Right.
Because let me tell you something, Jim. If a $3 trillion stimulus is passed on top of everything that's happened, those bond vigilantes are going to come out. They're going to crash the bond market.
I mean, I would think so, because, I mean, you know, and they're also trying to peddle, I think, $1 trillion worth of new issue or something to pay for the last 90 days of stimulus. And again, like the guy at Bridgewater was saying, there's no reason to believe that, you know, this couldn't go on for many more quarters. So if it goes on at many more quarters, and they have to keep injecting this type of money, it could get kind of hairy.
Well, I mean, Jim, if you had a credit card and you could call up anytime you wanted to increase your limit and use cash advances to make the minimum payment, why would you ever work?
Well, the other thing is, I believe that when you have a leverage buyout guy like Mnuchin with a real estate guy like Trump and a private equity guy like Powell, you got the recipe where these guys are not going to really care about debt.
Yeah, I think they should, Powell should take over Biden's basement, and it would be a lot. They should be maybe roommates. I don't know, because Powell talks a lot too much.
But he's private. He came from private equity, so he's not unfamiliar with leverage. He's not unfamiliar with debt. The other guy, you know, came from Goldman and did a lot of leverage buyouts with the banks during the crisis. And Trump, obviously a real estate guy, is no stranger to debt. So, you know, these guys are very, very comfortable with the debt, hoping that the revenues will come in when this economy goes back to whatever normal was. But, you know, kind of like in Atlantic City, if you take a lot of debt on, hoping the casinos will make a lot of money and they don't, then the debt can be very oppressive.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way I see it with all of this is, you know, it takes a while for inflation to kick in. It takes 1 to 3 years.
Right.
It's unbelievable. I still remember this when they had Jim Rogers on TV back in 2008, and they were cranking out about, I mean, back then, you know, $800 billion was massive, right?
Yeah, right.
And it was only a few months afterwards, and, you know, hotel rates were down. Prices at restaurants were probably not down, but, you know, other clothes were probably down. And then, you know, there was some guy saying, you know, Jim, you're just so wrong. You know, we had all this stimulus and there's no inflation. Why are you giving us a false narrative? Mm. And Rogers is looking at this guy saying, where does this guy come from? There's no such thing as printing money and not having inflation.
Yeah.
Just give it a little bit of time, you know?
Yeah.
But once we give it time, a year or two, you know, what's going to happen is a lot of the states are going to have record inflows. Because it's just new money and prices go up and things will go up, come back to normal. And, you know, for guys like us that remember, you know, a burger and fries costing $9.95 for lunch,
right?
You know, it's not really the kids and millennials that are going to have to adapt because they don't remember that. We're the ones that are going to have to adapt.
Yeah, because they're resetting everything and the millennials are not that familiar with what they've reset them from as much.
Exactly. And they don't have any money. So what do they care?
Well, we're at the top of the hour, Neil. So we want you to reintroduce yourself. We want you to, if you have any special offers, to please offer them and make sure people know exactly how they can get a hold of you to take advantage of your research and your viewpoint.
Sure. Okay. You can sign up for my newsletter at traderreview.net, and I give away a lot of good commentary, even if you're not a paid subscriber. If you want to be a paid subscriber, there will be a link somewhere in that email to sign up. I'll give you my exact picks, like we had today with Nail that was up at 1.8.5% today. I'm not sure what it is right now, but, you know, we always hold around 4 to 8 picks or so, just what I consider to be the best sectors and picks at the time. And we just basically, the philosophy is just to go with what's working right now.
All right, guys, that's how you get a hold of Neil and take a look at what he can do for you. With optionprofessor.com, we have a weekly market update letter where we cover stocks and the bond market, the U.S. dollar, international, crude oil, the metals, and the softs. Some of those have gone up quite a bit in the last month or so, so they've been interesting. So go to optionprofessor.com, put your email in there, and free of charge, the update comes to you each and every week. Right now, I'm going to send it back to David. Neil, nice talking to you as always, and David, please take it from here.
Pleasure, Dan.
Yep.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, you covered a lot of great information today, so just want to thank you both for being here, and just a quick reminder for everyone, be sure to subscribe to Timing Research on YouTube and your favorite podcast directory or app, and you can also go to timingresearch.com to get access to any of the past shows and reports there as well. Also, in case you didn't see this, last Wednesday, we recorded a special Fibonacci and Elliott Wave event. We had 12 presenters recording presentations there. And so that is available on Timing Research as well, if you haven't had a chance to check that out. So take a look there. And just want to thank my guests again for today, Neil Batho of TraderReview.net and the Option Professor of OptionProfessor.com. Thanks, everyone.